Hey, my name is Colton. I'm one of the serving leaders here at Ethos. Thank you so much for checking out our podcast today. We hope that you can lean in and enjoy this message.
Today, we're kicking off a brand new series. And if you're newer to Ethos, you came out on a really great Sunday. I always think it's a great Sunday to come for the first time when it's a new series, because we teach in series, kind of collection of talks. And this particular collection is going to be 4 weeks long. And we're really leaning into kind of this idea of our thought life. And what does it look like to win the war in our minds? A war that none of us are exempt from. There's a few series every so often that every single one of us has to say, oh yeah, no, that relates to me. There's nobody exempt from this one. There are some series like, yeah, that's good for my friend. This particular series is good for you, for me, and the people all around you right now. In fact, kind of the heart or the thesis of this series comes from Paul's teaching in Romans chapter 7 when he said, I've discovered this principle of life, that when I want to do what is right, I inevitably do what's wrong. Can anybody relate to the Apostle Paul right here? This is the guy, Fritz has got two hands up right there. This is the guy who wrote about 60% of the newer portion of our Bible called the New Testament. And yet, he's just speaking so personally in a way in which you and I can absolutely relate, or at least the four of you who were honest a moment ago. But Paul goes on and says, I love God's law with all of my heart, but there's another power that's at war within me, and it's at war with my mind. And today I want to share, as we kind of build a foundation, that's what this morning is. It's a foundation for where we're going to go over the next few weeks. And I believe that as we get what God is wanting to speak to us this morning, it's going to greatly help us lean into and apply what we're going to be discussing over the next 3 weeks. But I want to share this morning from a working title of I Have a Choice. Can you turn to the person next to you one more time this morning, look at them and say, you have a choice. You have a choice. Come on, turn to your second option right now. The person that you maybe don't know, let them know. Hey, you have a choice. Let them know. You have a choice. We all have a choice. When I was in third grade, I remember after church one Sunday afternoon, we went to Bob Evans. Because come on, somebody. Bob Evans is a gift from God. The biscuits with the butter and the honey poured on top, those are going to be in heaven. I don't know if you have read that scripture or not, but they're there. And we go to Bob Evans, and I remember we're waiting in the lobby, and my grandma and grandpa Smucker are with us, and we're waiting for our name to be called to be seated at our table. And my grandpa Smucker says, hey, Jordan, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, oh, well, Grandpa, I want to take over your business, and I want to be a pastor. And he looked at me in a way that only my grandpa Smucker could. And with a completely straight face, he said, you can't do both of them well. You got to choose one. You're going to do one. And then he got up and walked away. That's my grandpa Smucker. And he kind of burst my little third grade bubble dream in that moment, but Grandpa Smucker was onto something. In fact, for the next several years of my life, many of which I didn't really follow Jesus, but by the time I was a senior in high school, I really got serious about my faith. And I just kept going in this direction, what I believe God had called me to do, to pastor. It was not only a passion, but I really sensed kind of an impression from God. Oftentimes, it was just very gentle. It was kind of small. Sometimes I wasn't even sure if it was real, but I just had this sense that this was what God was calling me to do. And I remember about 6 years ago now when my wife and I were beginning to transition off of the church staff that we've been a part of for over a decade. Church who we had all of our friends were in that community. Many of our friends and us, we were on staff together. And we were having so much fun during that season. We just began to sense that God was calling us to move here and to start what we now know today as Ethos. And as a result, we kind of had all sorts of mixed emotions about it, as you can imagine. But I remember signing up for this church planting training where we had about 30 other couples, and we were going through this cohort together, and we would travel to different places and learn more and just connect. And I remember leaving one of those training sessions. Again, there's about 30 other couples there, and as we're getting on the airplane to come back home, I can recall having this thought, like, those guys are so much better than us. Those guys are way better pastors than us. They're way better leaders. They're way better at gathering people. They're way better communicators and preachers than us. Like, did we make the right decision? Like, are we sure we want to do this? I'm pretty good at talking myself into stuff, though. And so 2 weeks later, I'm like, no, man, this is, I'm ready to go. And I'm ready to take on the gates of hell with a water pistol. You know what I mean? Like we're going to do this thing, man. And only to discover maybe a few months after that, we were just getting ready to announce publicly that, hey, this was a decision we're about to make at that point. Only a few small handful of friends and our pastors knew at the time. And there was a morning when I woke up, maybe 2-3 in the morning. I'm not sure what time it was. And I just had this overwhelming like weight that I began to experience. And some of you can relate with this. It was the first time in my life where I had dealt with what I would describe today as like a bout of anxiety. And I woke up with a shortness of breath. And I got out of bed and I walked downstairs, the house, the home that we were living in. There was an office in the corner of the home. And I just began to kind of try to catch my breath. And God, what's going on? Just all these thoughts are racing through my head. Like, man, what are you doing, Jordan? You're going to ruin your family. You're pulling your kids out of their school. You're pulling them away from all of their friends. This is the most ridiculous decision you've ever made. Why are you doing this? And again, but maybe about a month later, I'm like back in it, man. I'm like, we're ready to go. This is going to be great. Let's do this. We're trying to rally a team. Maybe you can relate with this, sort of this feeling of just being back and forth in your mind. You ever been there before where you feel so certain, like there's this deep conviction around a biblical truth or resolve within your heart to change a bad habit in your life or to rid yourself of some toxic thoughts or to embrace a new habit that you're trying to kind of get into the rhythm of implementing it within your life, only to find out like 2 weeks later, you're kind of back and forth. And for a while, maybe even a long season of a month, a year, you kind of soar on the wings of that resolve, of the determination that you are going to make this happen, only to discover that you inevitably slip back into the same unfortunate patterns of doing life. Maybe at one point in your life, I know that this has been true for me. Sometimes I just feel guilty for even feeling guilty because I look at somebody else's life and I'm thinking, they have it so much worse than me. Why do I feel bad about what's going on right now? And as a result of just feeling guilty for feeling guilty, I find myself sort of on this toxic downward spiral of negative thinking. In fact, 3 weeks after Ethos had started meeting regularly on Sunday mornings, it was the first Monday of October in 2018. All of those toxic thoughts that were running through my mind for the last year and a half, they just started adding up one after another after another. And it felt like this heavy weight was just sitting on me. And there was that Monday morning in October of 2018 where I was on my kitchen floor. My wife and I were having a conversation. I was literally sitting on the floor and I don't even know why because it's not a regular part or rhythm of my life. I couldn't really even think clearly during that season. I was just trying to go through the motions of my day. I felt numb to basically everything that was going on around me. And all of a sudden, I just broke down, like sobbing hysterically. I actually felt so bad then even in that moment because my wife is just looking at her husband like, what is going on? I've never seen Jordan do this before. And all of it came back to this one singular thought. You are not enough. This series is really personal to me. In fact, I think though that this series is personal to you as well. This series is one of those, like I mentioned a moment ago, where none of us are exempt from it. We all carry with us thoughts that lead to bad behavioral patterns, that lead to toxic relationships. And all of it leads back to a singular thought. Did you know that the average person everywhere across the world, third world nation, and right here in our own backyard, experiences somewhere between 12,000 to 60,000 thoughts per day. And catch this, 80% of the thoughts that you and I think are negative, and 95% of those thoughts are the same negative thoughts that we had the day before. We all similarly find ourselves in this hamster wheel of negative thinking, this habitual cycle of being unable to break the habit of thinking these negative thoughts. In modern psychology, just in the past 6 decades, a discipline has developed called cognitive behavior therapy. It teaches that many problems from eating disorders to relational challenges, addictions, and even some forms of anxiety and depression, not all, but some forms of anxiety and depression are rooted in faulty and negative patterns of thinking. In fact, cognitive behavioral therapy, also known as CBT, tells us that treating these problems begins with changing the way that you think. Now, what's interesting is this is somewhat new to social science, but again, the scriptures, the Bible has been talking about this for millennia now. In fact, in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 7, Solomon writes, "For as he thinks in his heart, so is he. As a man or woman thinks, so they become. What you think about, you become. What Solomon is saying here is how we think inevitably will eventually, no one's exempt from this, it will shape your life. If you're feeling sad, and maybe you've experienced this before, and somebody comes along and they say, hey, don't feel sad. Just kind of get over it. And they're like, let's just put on some Bob Marley and let's just sing along together. Baby, don't worry about a thing, because every little thing is going to be... Yeah, second service, way less spiritual than the first. First service looked at me like this, like, I don't know that song. I listen to worship music all day. You're like, okay, sure, yeah. But if somebody does that, it doesn't help you, though. You don't suddenly be like, oh, yeah, you're right. Woo, I'm glad now. No, it doesn't work that way. Why is that? Well, it's because sadness is a symptom. It's not the problem. It's comparable to if you had a really bad cough and you just couldn't rid yourself of that cough. And you go to the doctor and the doctor says, you've got pneumonia. And you start sucking on some cough drops. Well, those cough drops, they're going to treat the symptom, but they will not cure the problem. Well, for us, most of the problems in our life stem from a thought. And a lot of times, though, what we think is we begin to treat the symptom, but it's the thought that we need to get to the root of. It's the thought that's causing the greatest problem in our lives. In fact, social science teaches us that a thought will lead to an emotion. And your emotions have a very strong grip on your behavior. And it's your behavior that begins to influence and determine the condition in the health of your relationships. And most of the time what happens then is our relationships, both good and bad, begin to further reinforce those toxic thoughts. And it's a habit, it's a cycle that we find ourselves in, both good, but oftentimes really bad. But it doesn't begin with an emotion, it doesn't begin with a behavior, it begins with a thought. And again, both science and scripture teach us that our lives are moving in the direction of your strongest thought, which is why this series is so critically important as Jesus followers, because none of us are exempt from this. 75 to 98% of one's mental, physical, and behavioral illness comes from your thought life. Have you ever seen a picture of some food at a restaurant and you're like, man, we got to go to that restaurant. Maybe it's a new local spot. You're like, we got to go check that out. Like my wife and I, we love checking out new restaurants. And whenever we go, what we'll usually do is get on Yelp and start looking at people's reviews. And we'll find people's pictures. And we're like, man, that one, like, I don't know what that's called, but can you just give me this one right here, please? I just want that plate right there. And every so often though, they'll bring the food out to you and you look at it and you're like, that does not look like the picture that I showed you, right? I think it's a little bit that same way with our lives. Like on the surface, I'll just tell it myself, that on the surface, or maybe even on paper, everything in your life is pretty good. Things are going outwardly the way that they probably should be going. And there's not a whole lot to really complain about. And you begin to think, man, like your life is awesome. Everything in your life is awesome. Like everything is awesome. Everything is good. Like it's just sing-along Sunday today, but like... Anyway, here we go. But you ask yourself, and this is where I've been so many times. On paper, it's good, but why then do I feel so tired, worn down? Not in body per se, but in my mind. Why does every day sometimes just feel like a battle to stay positive? Sometimes even just a battle to trust the truth of Jesus, just to follow Jesus. Why does it feel like sometimes it's just a battle to even stay encouraged? Well, here's a thought. Let me put this thought in our minds this morning. And here's kind of the foundation that we're laying for the next several weeks together. Maybe it's because it is a battle. Maybe because there really is a war in your mind. And maybe we've been, as Christ followers, sometimes treating what's happening in our mind simply as, man, it's like, we can handle that. No, you can't, not on your own. What's going on inside of each and every one of us really is a battle. There's a spiritual battle. In fact, Paul talks about it like this in Ephesians chapter 6, where he writes, put on all of God's armor so that you'll be able to stand firm against all the strategies of the devil. Now, here's what's interesting is that the Apostle Paul, who is writing here, he's actually writing to the church at Ephesus, the Ephesian church, and he's writing to a young pastor whose name is Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Timothy is the pastor here in Ephesians, and he says, fight the good fight for the true faith, Timothy. Again, using very similar language. In fact, Paul goes on in Ephesians 6, and he says, for we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. Paul is using some pretty demonstrative, bold language here. In fact, for a lot of us, if you grew up in church, or maybe you grew up in Sunday school, or you went to Vacation Bible School as a kid, you can hear these scriptures and you think, oh yeah, I've heard that before. Put on all of the armor of God. Yep. And you kind of got it like locked into your mind. Like instantly you hear the armor of God. And for some of you, you're like, I'm in the Lord's army. Yes, sir. I'm in the Lord's army. Yes, sir. I may never march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the... Come on, y'all. Actually, Bethany, thank you so much in the back. Second to last row, and yet still she's engaged with me. I may never fly over the... See, here's the thing about second service is y'all didn't grow up in church. And so... But here's what happens, though. Here's what happens. We hear these songs when we're kids, and they're good, and I'm all for them, and they teach these biblical truths. But as we grow into adults, we feel like we've matured out of them. And for many of us, then we don't even take them as seriously as we did when we were children. And I think that's happened as it relates to the way in which we are to engage in this battle, this war in our minds. And here's what's even more interesting. Think about this for just a moment. The language that Paul uses here, not just Paul, Peter talks about it like this. Several of the New Testament writers refer to there's a battle that's going on in your mind, in the unseen realm, so to speak. And this language is very counterintuitive, though, for a church in the first century that grew up around the life and the teachings of a rabbi, Jesus, who was fiercely nonviolent, who chose to die for his enemies in love rather than to kill them in battle. And yet still, writers in the New Testament and early church fathers and mothers who up until about the 4th century were almost all pacifists, all of them kind of refused to engage in war and fighting a physical manner, and yet they regularly use this imagery of war to describe the inner dynamics of the soul. Jenny Allen, in her book, Get Out of Your Head, fantastic book, by the way, she writes that the greatest spiritual battle of our generation is being fought between our ears. But who is the battle with? And this is where sometimes we miss out on engaging in the right battle because we're fighting the wrong ones. Because the battle is not with, it's not with one another. It's not with the latest legislation that's been passed down. It's not with some politician in office. It's not with Antifa or Proud Boys. It's not with your Facebook frenemy. Come on, somebody. The battle's not with your employer or the bully at school even. There's a much deeper battle. Now, some of that may be a symptom, but that is not the root of the problem. So who's the battle with? It's with the devil. Now, here's the moment in service today where if you're newer to Ethos, you lean over to your friend and you say, why did you invite me here? The guy's singing some weird army song, and now he's talking about the devil. Yeah, like, I know this is kind of odd, but it's only really been in the last 4 decades, since about the mid to late 80s, where the modern church has just altogether stopped talking about the devil. We went from one ditch to the other ditch, where we were kind of almost like devil hungry in one sense. We cast out devils everywhere we went, to being like devil naive. In fact, I think C.S. Lewis says it best in his book, Screwtape Letters, when he wrote that there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight. Lewis is essentially saying there's kind of two ditches that we find ourselves in as it relates to this topic. We either give him so much credit that we almost almost minimalize God in relationship to the devil, or we don't talk about him at all. And as a result, we're not even aware of the ways in which the devil is trying to influence not only you, but our friends as well. And here's what's kind of cool though, because Jesus talked about the devil, and we place our faith, our trust in Jesus. We believe that his words are truth. His words are authoritative, and his words are what we lean into the most. And Jesus, as gentle as he was, Jesus was also willing to go hard in the paint with some people too. Like Jesus in certain moments was a bit like Steph Curry, at other moments was a bit like Shaquille O'Neal with people. Like he was just battling people down low. And at one point in John chapter 8, Jesus begins to come at some folks, some religious leaders who are discrediting his authority. And listen to how strongly Jesus speaks to these religious leaders. He says, "For you are the children of your father, the devil." Jesus is like, "You want to come at me?" He's like, "I'm like the master wordsmith of them all." Like he says, "You are like your father, the devil, and you love to do evil things just like he does. He was a murderer from the beginning. He's always hated the truth. Why? Because there's no truth in him. For when he lies, it is consistent with his character, for he is a liar, and he's the father of all lies." Now catch this for just a moment, because for Jesus, the devil's real. He's not a myth. He's not a fictional villain from a Harry Potter novel. He's not Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live. Come on, somebody, anybody remember that? Just me, okay. No, the devil is a real and cunning creature, and he's got influence on the earth. Now, an in-depth study of the devil and his origins, we don't have time for today, nor do I actually even believe that we need to give much credit to, but here's what I do want us to get. Today, our culture has a very high value on keeping an open mind. And as it relates to this subject, that's all that I ask, is that all of us, whether you're new or you've been following Jesus for quite some time, but maybe some of your convictions have changed in this area, I just ask that you would simply consider the possibility that Jesus was right and that his words really are true. And as a result, the primary tactic of the devil is to get you to believe a lie. Because remember, Jesus said he's a liar and he's the father of all lies, the originator of deception, the devil, the originator of lies, the devil. One of the more unique privileges that I have as a pastor is I get to meet with so many different people with so many different backgrounds and different different places in the socioeconomic spectrum, grew up in different areas even of the country, different education backgrounds, even to a certain degree different beliefs around certain Christian theologies. And yet one of the things I've seen to be true of all people, myself included, and there's nobody that I've met who's exempt from this, is how many of us are so easily deceived as it relates to the lies in which we allow ourselves to believe, the ways in which we allow ourselves to think. It's the teenage girl who compares herself to the mirage on social media, and as a result comes to believe, "I'm ugly and I'm unworthy of love." It's the mom who was raised by a perfectionist mother and decades later still believes, "I have to be perfect to have peace." It's the parents whose children have deconstructed their faith, and as a result, they think, "Man, I failed at the one thing that matters the most. Therefore, I'm a failure," but we hold it in and we don't talk to anybody about it, and we begin to allow that toxic thought to lead us into a toxic downward spiral. It's the young person who sins and believes that everybody at church now judges me and I can't go back there anymore. It's the individual who's offended by somebody at church, and as a result, they believe that unity looks more like sameness rather than walking through difficult situations together, and they allow that to become a fraction within their family. It's the full-grown man who is berated by his father and comes to believe that "I'm only as good as I am successful at work." I've sat with so many pastors whose church maybe is in a season where it's not growing or possibly even declining. As a result, they begin to believe, "I'm not successful, and God was faithful to me once, but he hasn't been faithful to me recently. I no longer see God's blessing in our church. I need to move on to something else now." Just quick side note. One of the reasons why we don't talk about how many people come even on a Sunday morning is for this reason alone. because somewhere along the lines in kind of American church culture, we've defined success in a church as how many butts are in a seat. And just sometimes when we say that out loud, we're like, that is kind of weird. I come across pastors all the time, and I'm not trying to be rude, and I'm not trying to be other than hopefully over a period of time, possibly be a part of maybe changing some of the culture of this. And I'll just kind of pull back the curtain on some of what happens in pastoral conversations amongst one another. One of the initial questions that pastors will ask each other when you meet the pastor for the first time is they say, so what are you running on Sunday morning? How many people come to your church? And I almost always say, I'm sorry, we don't talk about that. Well, why? Because that actually doesn't really matter. It's just butts in a seat. I had the privilege years ago of sitting in a round table with Rick Warren, and I'll never forget the one line where he said, do not judge your church on the size of a Sunday morning, but judge your church based on how many people leave and live on mission on a Monday morning. Figure out how to get them there, not get them here. And then you may please the Lord your God. And yet too many of us find ourselves with these toxic thoughts. And as a result, they begin to influence not only our emotion and our behavior, but they begin to influence our relationships as well. And there's not a soul I know who is not living in, to some degree, to some level, bondage to the lies of the thoughts that run through their mind. Lies that originated from a thought, and a thought that came from the father of all lies. But here's the good news, and consider this for just a moment. Here's the really good news, that Jesus came as a rabbi, which is a modern day version of a teacher. Jesus could have come as many things. He could have come as a political leader. He could have come as a war general. He could have come as a politician, but he didn't. He came as a rabbi. Why? Well, what is a teacher? It's a truth teller. Because Jesus knew that to combat the lies of the devil, he needs to encourage us to lean into the truth of God. So he knew that this conquest, not a physical conquest, it was a conquest of the mind. It was a conquest to win the war that's going on right here between our ears. And this is what Jesus said about himself, that you will know the truth, and he's referring to himself as the truth. And he's saying we can know him. The word know here in the original language is the Greek word gnosko, which implies that you can know God the same way that you would know your spouse or your very best friend. He says in the truth, God's truth will set you free from the lies and the tyranny of bondage that holds us captive, that the devil himself is putting right here. And yet because we discredit it, because we're not aware of his strategies, we just continue to live in that habitual hamster wheel of believing that I am what the devil said I am, even though we probably wouldn't say it in those exact same words. But Jesus said, no. I want to set you free. I want to set you free, but the way that you do that is by believing in my truth. Not good conceptions, not good ideas, but truth. And something that I've noticed in my life, and maybe you notice this in your life at one point or another as well, is that I often don't overtly deny the validity of Jesus' teachings as truth, but what I do is sometimes I just doubt that his truth is for me. And as a result, I don't allow his truth to fully absorb itself into my heart and to shape my identity. And that's what we're after in this series. It's to slow down and consider, and this is what I'm praying. In fact, I want to ask even right now, that you would consider over the next few weeks, pray this with me, that as we begin to lean in for the next 4 weeks together, that this would not just be another TED Talk, that the words of Jesus would become a reality, not only in our lives, but in the lives of the people all around. I pray that you would consider even praying for the emerging generation. And if you're a young person, pray this for the older generation, that we would not buy into the lies of our generation or the lies of which we believed even as children and carried into our adulthood, but that we would begin to be transformed by the truth of God's word and God's word alone. In fact, I think what's happened is that a lot of times we've been taught, and at times the church has even aided in secularism here, that we've kind of bought into the lie that religious ideas like good and evil and God can't be known, that they can only be taken on by faith. But what's interesting is that for Jesus and the writers of the scripture, faith is based on knowledge. It's a kind of deep trust that is grounded in reality. Faith to the New Testament writers was not just simply close your eyes and just believe in faith. No, it was grounded in something concrete. It was grounded in truth, in knowledge, in knowing that you can actually know good, evil, and God himself. Elton Trueblood, he was a Quaker theologian and former chaplain of Harvard and Stanford universities. Like, how about that for an introduction? Yeah, I'm the chaplain for Harvard. Oh, really? Well, I was a chaplain for Yale. Yeah, I did it for Stanford too. You win. He said this. He said, faith is not belief without proof, but trust without reservation. How good is that? In other words, the question isn't, do you have faith? We all have faith. The question is, who or what do you have faith in? Who or what do you believe to be true? Because each of us are believing something to be true. And the narrative of our life is based on that thought of what you believe to be true. And the devil will shout at you. He will. He's going to tell you all sorts of things. He's going to tell you you'll never get out of debt. You're always going to be broke. He's going to tell you that your marriage is always going to be in the condition that it's in right now. You're never going to make a difference. You're never going to amount to anything. You're always going to be addicted to pornography. You're always going to have failed relationships. You're always going to be lonely. You're never going to find somebody. This is the condition that you will always find yourself in. And because that narrative has rung true in your thought life for so long, you'll always be anxious. You'll always be depressed. This is the story of your life. We grow so weary that we think, well, I guess that's true. I guess it's just how my life will, always be. But to follow Jesus as our rabbi, as our truth teller, it's a whole lot more than just enrolling as a student for a daily lecture, maybe even just a weekly lecture on a Sunday morning. It's also to enlist, listen to this language, it's to enlist as a soldier and join his fight to believe truth over lies. And it is a fight. There's a war in your mind. There's a war for your mind. There's a war for your thoughts. So what do we do? I'm going to leave you with this one practical note here, and then we're going to dig into a whole bunch more in the weeks to come. In fact, next week, Dr. Tammy Smith, who is just brilliant, I encourage you to be here next week. Bring your friends next week. I know you already will, because whenever Dr. Tammy comes, the place packs out. It kind of hurts me a little bit, but it is what it is. I told Dr. Tammy that. I said, man, the church loves you, Tammy. They love you. She said, oh, that's so kind of you. I said, no, Tammy. I said, they love you more than me. I said, you gotta come. You gotta help me out. Bail me out. No, she was sharing with me yesterday a bit of what she's gonna teach on next week. And I'm telling you, I said, yes, please. That is so good. She's gonna lead us in an exercise. It's almost like we're gonna be in a therapy session with her. I'm telling you, it'll be worth coming to next week. And I kind of hate to use some of that language. I don't like hyperbole in church, but I really think it's going to be one of those moments that we look back on even as a church, and we're like, that shaped our church right there, that moment. But here's what I want to leave us with today. Paul says it like this. So how do we take this and put into practice this week? Paul writes, we need to demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. We need to learn to take captive every thought, and to make it obedience to Christ. To recognize, if that thought is not the truth of what God said, I need to bring that into obedience to the truth of what Jesus says about me. But let's not be naive. This is a tall task right here. This is no small thing that Paul is instructing us here. Because again, you and I experience 12,000 to 60,000 thoughts per day. So good luck taking every single one of those thoughts captive. But here's what I want to give us this morning, an effort to kind of bring this back down to ground level. We can learn to take one thought captive. And in doing so, I believe that we'll learn to take every thought captive. And here's that thought right here. I have a choice. Can we all say that out loud together? I have a choice. I want us to learn this week, in the month to come, in the year to come, that you have a choice. Every thought that comes your way, you have a choice. Do I accept this as truth? Or do I recognize this as a lie? I have a choice. You have a choice when that thought comes. Now, some of us have developed neural pathways so deep in our brain, in our basal ganglia. Come on, remember all that from a few weeks ago? Some of y'all may recall, we've developed them so deep that we got to have significant grace. Give yourself grace as you begin to develop new neural pathways of thinking, because the enemy has lied to you for so long that that pathway is so deeply entrenched into the soil of your soul, of your mind, of your brain. Side note, whenever you see in the scriptures the heart or the soul reference in the Old Testament, it's almost always in direct reference to what modern scholars refer to as your brain. They think that Old Testament writers were referring to your thought life, your mind, your will, your emotions. And you and I have a choice. We have a choice to believe something is true or not to. And if you have trusted Jesus as your Savior, you have the power of God to choose. And so you do not need to accept the authority of the devil as truth in your life. No, you can choose. Romans chapter 8 says the same spirit that raised Christ from the dead lives and dwells and breathes in your body. You got a choice. So you don't need to just succumb to this false narrative of thinking, that's how I'll always be. That's the state of my relationships. That's the state of my marriage. No, listen to me. You have a choice. You have a choice. Some of you right now need to begin to choose to think differently about your relationships, to think differently about your spouse. You've got the 80% really good, but you're thinking about that friend on Facebook. You're thinking about that sweetheart you once had, and you've got a choice to say, no, 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 no. I'm going to get that thought out of there. Affairs don't happen overnight. Broken relationships don't happen overnight. They happen right here with a thought. And you and I, we've got a choice. You don't have to be addicted to pornography for the rest of your life. You've got a choice. I have a choice. Again, give yourself grace. So when you fall back down, get back up. I've got a choice. I have a choice over a period of time, a long obedience in the same direction. God will begin to shape new neural pathways in your brain. You and I have a choice. We have a choice. You are not subject to your behaviors, genes, or circumstances. You are not subject to your passions, lusts, and emotions. We have a choice. You are not subject to your thoughts. You are not subject to the lies of the enemy when we have the truth of Jesus at our disposal. We have a choice. I'm going to close right here. I've always believed lies my whole life. In fact, not only have I believed lies, but there have been whole seasons of my life that have been built around lies, entire chapters that are built around them. The prevailing lie in my life since I was a young kid, and I did not recognize this lie. I did not know that this was the prevailing lie. I didn't know it until about 3.5 years ago. And so for much of my life, I believe this one singular lie. I am not enough. Seasons of my whole life I look back on. Now for me, it's played out a little bit differently. It's kind of a running joke in my family that if you tell Jordan he can't, he will prove that he can. And if he ends up not being able to, he'll just burn himself out. That's what's happened to me several times. Because of that prevailing thought, that narrative, you are not enough. You are not good enough to pastor a growing church. You're not enough. You're not a good enough leader. Almost, not every time, but almost every time I'm about to walk on stage, I hear this little thought. What you have prepared isn't good enough. It's not going to help anybody. If you give all your attention to the church, you're not going to be enough for your family. If you give all your attention to your family, you're not going to be enough for the church. You're never going to meet everybody's expectations, Jordan. You're not enough. And now here's what's interesting, though, is that with that lie, just like every lie that the enemy puts into your mind, it's the same thing. There are significant elements of truth wrapped in that lie. I'm not enough. I'm never going to be enough. I will never be enough. But, and here's where the truth comes in. I've had to learn to lean into what Peter wrote in 1st and 2nd Peter chapter 1. By his divine power, God has given us, and I make this personal to me when I read it, that God has given me everything I need for living a godly life. So every so often the enemy will come and say, Jordan, you don't live a righteous enough life. You don't pray enough. You don't fast enough. You don't do all the things enough to lead the church. And I say, oh yeah, no, you're right. I don't. I'm going to keep getting better. I'm going to keep making strides moving forward. But what I've discovered in my life and what we need to begin to discover in our own lives is that Jesus is more than enough. And so in every way in which I'm not enough, Jesus said, oh, but my grace is more than sufficient for you. We have received all of this by coming to know him, the one who called us to himself by means of his marvelous glory and excellence. You're right. I'm not enough, but I have a choice to believe that Jesus is more than enough. And so this week, as we move forward, we take captive every thought that comes into our mind by remembering, I have a choice. You have a choice. That we even encourage our friends, no, you got a choice. Do not give credit to that lie that has been running rampant in your mind. You got a choice. You have a choice.